Before long, we'll be where it would have taken mankind millions of years of learning to reach.
And what will Mitchell learn on getting there? Will he know what to do with his power?
That's the big agenda here, is undermining the whole idea of journalism, and that's the real thing to worry about.
The good old Ministry of Truth has another outlet.
Too often, broadcast radio insults your intelligence instead of respecting it, improving it, challenging it. But not here. Where knowledge is power, this is Powerful Radio. This is 30 minutes of information and inspiration. This is the Ministry of Truth. Hello and welcome to the Ministry of Truth. I'm Mitchell Stripinchuk. On today's show, we'll hear a presentation by Joey Mogul, an attorney with the People's Law Office in Chicago, entitled Torture, Home and Abroad, Law Enforcement and Military Officials. We'll also hear a commentary from the website Black Agenda Report. But now, a collection of news about media and democracy from the show Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
This spring, Time Warner Cable announced that it would begin charging their internet customers based on bandwidth consumption, putting caps on what used to be an unlimited service. One of the three cities targeted to test out the new pricing scheme was Rochester, New York. A group of doctors complained to Congressman Eric Massa that their broadband bills would triple overnight, from about $50 per month to a whopping $150 per month. And a local consumer reporter named Philip Dampier began organizing opposition to the price hikes online at a site he called Stop the Cap. Thousands of calls and letters, encouraged by Stop the Cap and Free Press, began coming into Capitol Hill, pointing out that the extreme price hikes seemed completely disconnected from any increased costs facing the company. And under pressure from Massa and New York Senator Chuck Schumer, Time Warner Cable dropped their plan for now. Time Warner characterized the move as a temporary setback, saying that the public only needed to be educated about the consumer benefits of their scheme. Massa wants to make sure that any efforts to institute unfair broadband pricing schemes are stopped before they begin. He spoke with the press last week about his new bill, H.R. 2902, the Broadband Internet Fairness Act.
This bill aims to do one basic thing, increase competition, by addressing and requiring internet service providers to submit plans to the Federal Trade Commission in very close consultation with the FCC if they plan to move to a usage-based plan. It prohibits volume usage plans if the FTC determines that these plans are imposing rates, terms, and conditions, and this is very important, that are unjustly unreasonable, unreasonably discriminatory.
Philip Dampier of StopTheCap.com told reporters that most internet service providers are moving towards these pricing schemes, and some are already in the testing phase.
AT&T is testing their own cap program in two cities. And additionally, we have concerns from people who have satellite and other kinds of technologies to receive this data that are all facing limits. It's sort of a limbo dance to the bottom. Who can set the lowest cap for the highest price?
Massa said that the success of the bill will be driven by the millions of consumers who contact their representatives.
This is all about getting citizens involved in legislation. So someone asked me the other day, well, why do you have all these people involved in this? And the answer is because we're doing the people's business.
For more information about the Broadband Internet Fairness Act, go to freepress.net or stopthecap.com.
The Allied Media Conference began 11 years ago as an event focused mostly on independent print and zine publishers. But over the past decade, the conference has transformed along with the media and now incorporates a wide range of issues and includes artists, educators, and social justice organizers who use media as a tool for change. This year's conference will take place on July 16th to the 19th in Detroit, with 1,000 participants from across the country. Allied Media's Jenny Lee talks about the conference's connection to the city, which has been grappling with the collapse of the auto industry.
Well, there's a conversation that's grown over the past few years about the role of independent media making in advancing new forms of economic development in Detroit. And right now, with the broadband work that's happening, and Michigan has this emerging film industry, and a lot of the independent media work that's been on the ground for so many years, it's all kind of converging to really advance a new vision for the role of media, arts, and culture in transforming cities like Detroit that have been tied to more industrial forms of economic development.
This year's conference will also go international. Using Skype, conference participants will have interactive live sessions with communities across the globe. That includes a live press conference with people in Atenco, Mexico, who have been using video to tell the world about their indigenous community's struggle with the Mexican government over land. There will also be a conversation between U.S. and Palestinian youth media organizations.
going from Detroit, from our very local and unique context here, to the national relationships that have been built through the AMC over the years beyond the U.S. and connecting with people in other places who face such similar struggles as a lot of communities in the U.S. here, and are using media in really similar ways to advance, you know, the transformation of the world that we need to see.
The Allied Media Conference is also about creating media. One workshop will connect hip-hop artists in Johannesburg, South Africa, who will be using file-sharing software to share beats and write songs, performing live via Skype.
There's an open media lab in the basement of the conference center where people can go throughout the weekend to really just get their hands dirty with making media. And this year, it's even going to involve building the technology that we use for our media production.
That includes building a 1-watt radio transmitter, as well as taking apart and rebuilding computers with open source software for a new community media center set to open in Detroit in the fall. For more information about the Allied Media Conference, visit alliedmediaconference.org.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
And now, a commentary from the website Black Agenda Report.
It's often been said that there would be no first black U.S. president were it not for the civil rights movement, and that's obviously true on its face. But what happens when the first black president fails to enforce civil rights laws already on the books? The National Black Chamber of Commerce, with encouragement from the heads of a Conference of Black Mayors and the National Black Caucus of Black State Legislators, charges Barack Obama's Federal Highway Administration isn't enforcing key portions of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. As a result, black contractors in states across the country have increasingly been shut out of federal highway construction work. Harry C. Alford, the National Black Chamber of Commerce president, dates the problem to the tail end of the Clinton administration. Since then, he says, many thousands of black firms and millions of black citizens have been denied an equal opportunity for contracts and employment in the transportation sector. The flaunting of civil rights laws has been allowed to fester so long, said Alford. You can take a drive on Interstate 80, starting in San Francisco, and drive all the way to New Jersey, and there's a good chance you will not see one black working on a freeway construction project. The black contractors and elected officials now fear that African Americans will be cut out of the huge one-time increase in federal highway money under the economic stimulus program passed this year. Their letter to administration officials was quite blunt, referring to money that is coming down through racist channels and demanding to see change from the administration and to see it now. The Black Chamber of Commerce would be well advised not to hold its breath. President Obama's well-known modus operandi is to run from racial issues like the plague. He treats civil rights as a done deal, an accomplished fact, for which we should all be grateful and then collectively move on. Obama hammered the point home yet again in early May when he told a press conference that he had no plans to directly address historically high black unemployment. The president whipped out the old discredited cliché that a rising tide lifts all boats and promised that his stimulus program would create that rising tide. But, as the Chamber of Commerce president wrote in his letter, the stimulus money will be directed through those same racist channels that have been denying blacks contracts and jobs. Unless the president puts on the pressure, there's no reason to expect any change at the Federal Highway Administration that black folks can believe in. Remember also that Obama insisted he wanted to pump additional money into state and federal programs that were shovel-ready, meaning projects that were already in the pipeline and could be put into motion quickly. By definition, this meant the usual suspects would get the contracts and the jobs. If blacks were shut out before the Obama administration, they would be shut out of the stimulus. It's as simple as that. Far from ushering in a new era, Obama's philosophy of governance reinforces the racial status quo, which, for black people at a time of economic crisis, means falling further behind. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford. On the web, go to www.blackagendareport.com.
You're listening to The Ministry of Truth. I'm Mitchell Stepinchuk. We now feature a presentation by Joey Mogul, an attorney with the People's Law Office in Chicago. The presentation is entitled Torture, Home and Abroad, Law Enforcement and Military Officials. The following presentation was given at the 2009 conference of the Illinois Coalition for Justice, Peace, and the Environment and recorded on Saturday, April 18, 2009.
How's everybody doing here? Are we in a food coma? Did we have anyone just eat? I believe I was asked to come today to talk about the Chicago police torture cases, otherwise known as the Burge torture cases. And I'm just curious, how many people know about these cases? Okay, we got a lot of people who know about these cases, and that's awesome. Quickly, you know, the torture cases involve the torture of over 100 African-American men from 1972 to 1991 at two police area headquarters, Area 2 and Area 3, that were on the south side of Chicago. And this torture was committed by John Burge and detectives under his command. And when we use the word torture, we're not exaggerating, we're not flippant, we're not looking for attention. We are adequately and rightly characterizing the torture and the cruel and inhuman and degrading treatment these African-American men and women suffered. African-American men were electrically shocked with what is known as a Tucker telephone. It's a box that has a crank, and it has wires that come from it that are attached to these alligator clips. It's a device that John Burge picked up when he was a military police officer over in Vietnam, and he transported it here back to Chicago. And what he would do is he would take this device and he would attach the alligator clips to men's lips, to their genitals, to their ears. And then he would crank the device, shooting electricity throughout their body. In some instances, men were tortured and electrically shocked with a cattle prod. Leroy Orange, one of the torture victims, was anally raped with a cattle prod. In many cases, men were suffocated with plastic bags, and they were beaten about their body, forcing them to breathe out, and then suck the bag in so that they realized that they, in fact, were suffocating. In other instances, men were beaten with telephone books or rubber hoses or blackjacks, instruments that caused severe pain but would leave no marks and therefore would go undetected. In almost all of the cases, individuals were interrogated for hours and hours on end, deprived of food, deprived of sleep, and deprived of bathroom facilities, and in many ways humiliated when forced to defecate or urinate on themselves. In addition to this crucial and excruciating physical torture they were subjected to, they were also psychologically tortured. Now, it's really uncomfortable for me to share the words that these white detectives used when interrogating these African-American individuals, but I use them because I think it gets to the heart of the racism that is the key and crucial part of this torture scandal. So many of these white detectives, when talking to these individuals, would call them nigger. That torture box I described was known as the nigger box. One of the African-American individuals who was being tortured was threatened with hanging, which was an obvious reference to lynching. And in too many cases, the white detectives would go up to people and say, no one's going to believe you if you report this torture. Because who are they going to believe? A white police officer like me or a nigger like you? And these cops knew. They knew that they could commit these acts of torture and get away with it. Because no one, judges, juries, prosecutors, and in some cases their own defense attorneys, no one would believe the stories of what happened to these torture victims. And instead, they would believe that they confessed voluntarily and freely, and that those confessions would be used against them. I think that the name-calling, these racial epithets, these racial slurs, it's racist terrorism. that I consider to be the heart of the Chicago police torture scandal. In all of the cases that we're aware of, all of the victims were African Americans. And the detectives who committed this, they were all white. And we've known for years, over the last 20 years, evidence has been collected that well establishes that this torture not only was committed, but that it was systemic, and that the commanders knew about it, condoned it, and continually allowed it to happen. The fact is back in 1982, Andrew Wilson was tortured by John Burge and other white detectives. And Andrew Wilson was accused of killing two white police officers. And the Chicago Police Department was out for blood. And when they got Andrew Wilson, after conducting a racist manhunt on the South Side, where they repeatedly searched African-American individuals, stormed people's homes, kicked down doors, searched people's houses, they were out for blood. And by the time they got Andrew Wilson and they brought him back to the station, they tortured him, not only with that electric shock box, not only suffocating him, and not only beating him, but burning cigarette butts out on his body. And when shocking him, he was handcuffed to a radiator. And each time they'd shock him, he would flinch, which would cause him to back up. And he then suffered burns across his thighs and his body from his radiator. So in Andrew Wilson's case, so unlike so many others, there was documented evidence of his torture. After his interrogation, he was brought to Cook County Jail. When he got to Cook County Jail, he finally got access to medical treatment at Cermak Hospital, where he was treated. And the head of Cermak Hospital, a man named Dr. John Rado, he came and interviewed Andrew Wilson, and he documented the injuries on his body, the burns, the physical bruises, the swelling. And he noted there were 17 different bruises or injuries on his body. And he, at that time, in 1982, wrote the then superintendent of the Chicago Police Department, William Breezek. And he said,
Richard.
I'm sorry, you're right, Richard. Thank you, so thank you, yes. Sorry, Richard Breezek. I'm thinking of William Kunkel, who's the lawyer who defended Burge, apologize. So Richard Breezek was informed of this torture. And he was not only informed of Andrew Wilson's injuries, but he was informed of the torture and he was told to investigate. Instead of investigating, what he did was he wrote to the head of the Cook County State's Attorney's Office at that time, who was now our mayor, Richard M. Daley. And he said, what do you want me to do in these cases? Because I know that you're prosecuting Andrew Wilson for the murder of these two white police officers. At that point, Richard Daley was empowered. He had the power to investigate these acts of torture, crimes, international human rights violations. And he didn't. Instead, he took Andrew Wilson's confession that was tortured out of him, and he used it against Andrew Wilson in his criminal case, not only to convict him, but to put him on death row. And as a result of Richard Daley's failure to investigate these torture cases, over 55 additional African-American people were tortured by John Burge and the white detectives under his command at Area 2 and Area 3 police headquarters. Now, as many of you know, obviously people know the names of some of the key characters in this story better than I even in this audience, but there was a long campaign for justice in these cases. And I can tell you, it's not through the litigation alone, or even primarily through the litigation, that there's been any justice in these cases. I think the justice has come from the continual organizing and activism on behalf of the torture survivors and their families and the individuals who keep suffering that we've seen any justice in these cases. As people may know, John Burge was ultimately fired from the Chicago Police Department in 1993. That was in large part due to people continually taking to the streets, marching in front of the mayor's office, protesting the FOP to get him fired. Over the years, there's been attempts to get these officers prosecuted, because while Burge was fired from the police department, not a single one of the other detectives was ever disciplined in any way. And while Burge was fired, he was still allowed to keep his police pension. And many of these other detectives, not only were they not disciplined, but they were promoted, and they were allowed to retire from the Chicago Police Department with their full pensions intact. It's clear these officers enjoyed impunity with respect to these international human rights violations. Meanwhile, the victims have continued to suffer. To this day, they still psychologically suffer. Many have post-traumatic stress disorder from the torture they endured. Right now, we know of over 20 African-American men who still languish in prison as a result of wrongful convictions that were based in whole or in part on their confessions that were tortured out of them. Right now, there are campaigns seeking justice in these cases, trying to get Lisa Madigan, our current Illinois Attorney General, responsible for prosecuting these men, maintaining their convictions, to grant them new hearings so that they can have a full and fair opportunity to present the torture that's used against them. And while we've been amazingly successful due to tireless efforts to now have the U.S. Attorney's Office indict John Burge for acts of perjury and obstruction of justice he's committed when lying about the torture he and other detectives committed under oath, we still await the day we see other of these torturers indicted for these crimes. People like Peter Dignan and John Burge's right-hand man. And meanwhile, I think there can be no true justice in these cases until these individuals receive financial reparations for the torture they endured. I have 1 minute. So in close, I want to say that as a civil rights attorney, as an activist, and as someone who represents people on death row, I'm very suspicious about seeking justice through the criminal injustice system. I like to call it the criminal legal system. And as a queer person, I gotta tell you, I say queer is a term we can reclaim. I don't want my community, I don't want other oppressed communities to often to look to the criminal legal system for some sort of compensation. I don't support hate crime laws. I don't think we should look to police and prosecutors and judges for justice. But I will say that in the Chicago police torture cases and in other torture cases, government torture cases, I think the individuals who drafted the CIA memos that the Obama administration saying they're not going to prosecute need to be prosecuted in these cases. And I just want to say, with respect to police officers, they know that they have power. And they know that people will listen to them, find them credible, and look the other way when they commit these international human rights violations. They know that they have impunity with respect to their crimes. And the fact is, we can sue them in the courts and get some justice on behalf of our individual clients. And we can, occasionally maybe get the OPS or IPRA to take action in a modicum of the cases. But the fact is, it really doesn't do anything for systemic justice. We, to this day, continually see the repeater beaters and the others who go out there and violate people's rights, violate people's dignity, take away their self-determination on a day-in, day-out basis. Until we have criminal prosecution of these officers, and they realize there are consequences for their violations, I don't think we're going to ever see any justice or change in these cases. And that's why I'm here today to say I do support the prosecution of Burge and Byrne and these other torturers. And I hope that we go after these CIA interrogators and we go after these individuals like you and Bybee and others who sat there in their offices and sat there and rationalized how they could inflict the most evil and insidious torture on individuals in United States custody. To sit there and cold-heartedly decide how to inflict that kind of pain and that kind of suffering, I think there's got to be some sort of accountability for that.
How about the doctor?
And I'll leave that for you to discuss in the breakout room. Thank you, guys.
Wow.
That was a presentation by Joey Mogul, given at the 2009 conference of the Illinois Coalition for Justice, Peace, and the Environment on Saturday, April 18, 2009. To learn more about the Illinois Coalition for Justice, Peace, and the Environment, go online to www.icjpe.org. That's the Illinois Coalition for Justice, Peace, and the Environment, icjpe.org. Listen to all past episodes of the Ministry of Truth online at www.szcz.org. That concludes this episode of the Ministry of Truth. Special thanks to Mario and the staff of WHPK Radio in Chicago. Thank you for listening.